Nehemiah chapter 13, beginning at verse 15. In this last half of the last chapter of Nehemiah, we see the final reforms that Nehemiah made when he came back to Jerusalem for his second term as governor. Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 15. In those days I saw in Judah some people treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves, and loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Men of Tyre dwelt there also, who brought in fish of all kinds of goods, and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah, and said to them, "What evil thing is this that you do, by which you profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do thus, and did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Yet you bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." So it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, that I commanded the gates to be shut, and charged that they must not be opened till after the Sabbath. Then I posted some of my servants at the gates, so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. Now the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. So I warned them and said to them, "Why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you." From that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves, and that they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy. Let's look at this last part of Nehemiah in two sections. Let's take a couple of background notes here, a doctrinal point and a practical application, and then move on to the last section of the chapter. A few background notes. We saw that in Nehemiah's first term as governor of Judah, the wall of Jerusalem was rebuilt. This was the wall that had been destroyed many years before when the Babylonians had conquered Jerusalem and had taken the Jews into captivity. We also saw that associated with this rebuilding of the wall, there was a great revival of the people. In chapter 10, we saw that the people had committed themselves in writing to fully obey and follow the Lord. But now here in chapter 13, we see that the focal points of commitment of chapter 10 have become focal points of failure. The people have failed and backslidden. Now, as many as 14 to 15 years have gone by between the commitments in chapter 10 and the failures that we see here in chapter 13, it's during this time that the people have backslidden. We see from verse 6 of this chapter that Nehemiah had gone back to Persia after 12 years, but now he returns to Jerusalem for his second term as governor, and he begins to bring about reform. In the first half of this chapter, we saw that Nehemiah corrected the problem concerning support of the Lord's servants and support for the house of the Lord. Now here in verses 15 through 22, we see Nehemiah dealing with problems connected with the Sabbath day, that people were buying and selling on the Sabbath day and treating it like any other day, and that was against the law. What is our doctrinal point or teaching point from this section? Here it is. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. This is what our Lord Jesus said about the Sabbath in Mark 2:27. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. God did not come up with the Sabbath and make it a law so that he could crack the whip over Sabbath breakers. No. God gave the Sabbath to mankind as a day of rest. God did not create us so that we could go nonstop. We need daily rest and we need weekly rest. You cannot go, go, go and burn a candle at both ends, even in the ministry. We're going to be busy, that's biblical, but we need periodic rest. God gave the Sabbath for rest for man. Now, we've already seen back in our studies of chapter 10 that we're not to take the Sabbath and legalize it and make it the Christian Sunday. No, the Sabbath was a ceremonial law, and the law ended with Christ. Remember Romans 10:4, Christ is the end of the law. But the principle of the Sabbath is a moral principle, and that still holds today. We must take time out from our normal workload and rest, and specifically give this time to worship God, our Creator. Practical application from this section. Do whatever it takes to be holy. Let's do whatever it takes to be holy. Remember what the word holy means? That we should be set apart for God's use. We're commanded to be holy in 1 Peter 1:15 and 16. Be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, "Be holy, for I am holy." We must do whatever it takes to be holy. Now note Nehemiah's actions in this section of Nehemiah. He knew that the Sabbath was to be kept holy, and he does what it takes to keep the Sabbath holy. He contended with the leaders there in verse 17. He commanded that the gates be shut during the Sabbath, verse 19. And by the way, the Sabbath begins on Friday night. That's why you read in verse 19, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, he commanded that the gates be shut. And then he posted guards. Now, this was not commanded by the law, but Nehemiah is doing whatever it takes to keep the Sabbath holy. Now, I think there's a spiritual lesson here for us. We need to do whatever it takes to be more holy. Maybe we need to regulate what we read or what we watch on TV. Maybe we need to regulate the videos we rent. We need to do whatever it takes to be more holy. Maybe we need to force ourselves to set aside more time for God, more time in prayer, for example. We all need to do whatever it takes to be more holy, that is, set apart for God. All right, let's go now to the last section of this chapter 13 and pick it up then in verse 23 and read through the end of the chapter. In those days, I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women?" And one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat, the Horonite. Therefore I drove him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I cleanse them of everything pagan. I also assign duties to the priests and the Levites, each to his service, and to bringing the wood offering and the first fruits at appointed times. Remember me, O my God, for good. So once again, we'll take a couple of background notes from this section, then a doctrinal point and a practical application. Background notes. The pagan women that we read of here that the Jews had intermarried with, they're from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, verse 23. These were Persian provinces surrounding the province of Judah. Intermarrying with these surrounding pagans was prohibited by the law. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 7 in this connection. God did not want the false religions of the pagans creeping into Israel. Remember, this was one of the areas where they had committed themselves to be faithful back in chapter 10. And here we see they have failed. Even a grandson of the high priest had married the daughter of Sanballat. Sanballat, you remember him? He was one of the enemies. Now, one more background note. I think we should say something about the stern and harsh actions that we see Nehemiah taking here. There in verse 25, we see he contended and cursed the Jews who had sinned in this area. Now, cursed here does not mean that Nehemiah took the name of the Lord in vain or something like that, but he's calling down judgment, the judgment of God on them, because Nehemiah knew that this was a serious sin and could lead to the fall of the kingdom once again. Let me just read in this connection from Deuteronomy 7, the chapter I referred to. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. "Nor shall you make marriages with them." This is the surrounding pagans. "You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly." Now, as to Nehemiah actually using physical force here, his physical handling of the offenders, striking them and pulling out some of their hair that we read here in verse 25, probably from their beards, we need to remember this. Nehemiah was the governor. He did have legal power. He's not just a Jewish leader operating under the Mosaic law, but he's a government representative of Artaxerxes I, the Persian emperor. And Artaxerxes had given Nehemiah sovereign power over the province of Judah. So Nehemiah is not just a godly bouncer here. Well, what about a doctrinal point or teaching point from this section? Here it is. Children get mixed signals in a mixed marriage. I think the Bible teaches that, and we see it brought out here. Children get mixed signals in a mixed marriage. When we say a mixed marriage, we're not talking about an interracial marriage. We're talking about a marriage where one parent is a Christian and one parent is a non-Christian. One of the reasons why God has said that Christians should not be, quote, unequally yoked together with unbelievers, that comes from 2 Corinthians 6:14. One reason for this is because children of a mixed marriage get mixed signals. Note verse 24 again. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. I think there's a spiritual lesson here for us. In a mixed marriage, it's almost impossible to have a Christ-centered home. And when you don't have a Christ-centered home, your children get taught both Christian principles and worldly principles. Directly or indirectly, they get taught both a Christian worldview and a non-Christian worldview. They speak a mixed language, as it were. They get mixed signals. You know, at camp every summer, we work with teenagers. Many of them come from mixed marriages where the home is not Christ-centered. They come with mixed signals, a mixture of Christian values and attitudes and non-Christian values and attitudes. Listen, if you're not married at this time, determine to marry in the Lord, because children get mixed signals in a mixed marriage. Practical application. Never think that you're so strong or so blessed that you can't fall into sin. Never think that you're so strong or so blessed that you can't fall into sin. Look at verse 26 again. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Solomon, great king of Israel, greatly blessed of God, and yet he fell into sin. With Solomon, it was the sin of marrying pagan wives who caused his heart to turn away from the Lord. But this principle certainly can be extended to other areas. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12 says, "Let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." It happened to Solomon. It happened to some in Nehemiah's day. It could happen to any one of us. Now, if you're saying right now, "Oh, not me. I'm strong. I'm blessed. No way." That's a sign that you're vulnerable. When you think that you're strong and blessed, watch out. Never think that you're so strong or so blessed that you can't fall into sin. Well, this brings us to the end of the book of Nehemiah. Now, this doesn't sound like a good place to end, does it? With the backslidden people. Well, the book actually ends on a good note, because Nehemiah has come back and he's gotten everything straightened out. Look at verse 30. "Thus I cleansed them of everything pagan." What a great spiritual leader we've seen in Nehemiah, a dedicated and committed servant of the Lord. Let's follow the model of Nehemiah, as well as follow the biblical principles we've learned from this wonderful book of Holy Scripture.